make sure to adjust the microphone so we can pick up the oral recording of the arguments. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Also, make sure to watch the timer, the monitor is over to your right, to make sure that you're staying on time as well.
Very well, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm Jim Ballmer. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Thomas Sullivan. He is the guardian for his ward, Mark Beeman. The facts in the case are set out in Judge Hilden's order granting summary judgment to defendant, but I want to focus on the key parts as I go forward this morning. Mr. Beeman was the victim of alleged malpractice that left him severely brain damaged, and so he prosecuted a medical malpractice claim for the brain damage. The malpractice claim resulted in a settlement of nearly $2 million on his behalf. After payment of fees and costs, $300,000 of that was set aside for Mrs. Beeman for her consortium claim. The balance then belonged to Mark Beeman, and it was concluded by the Beemans and their lawyer at the time that they needed a special needs trust. I could spend an hour explaining to you what the details of the requirements for one are. The point is there are numerous technical requirements surrounding the formation and use of the proceeds of a special needs trust. So Mr. Boggio, the defendant in this malpractice action, was retained. He met with both Mr. and Mrs. Beeman, discussed the notion of proceeding with the special needs trust, and then they decided they retained Mr. Boggio to go forward with that. Now, in the meantime, Mrs. Beeman and Mr. Beeman wanted to buy a new house that they thought might be suitable for Mr. Beeman in his semi-invalided state. So they asked Mr. Boggio if that would be possible, and he explained according to... They thought they did.
What did the retainer agreement say?
There was no written retainer agreement at that time. I don't recall seeing a written retainer agreement.
Okay,
but
so what proof is there that he was retained by both parties then?
What I said, I didn't say that that Mark Beeman formally retained them. I said he thought they did.
Who thought they did?
Mark Beeman did, and his family did. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that. I should have said they thought they retained him. And they both received legal advice from him about the special needs trust. The three of them met in the presence of the Beeman's daughter, Katie. And the conversation was between defendant and both Mr. and Mrs. Beeman about the special needs trust.
Okay, so let's jump forward a little bit. So that provision in terms of the joint tenancy in the house, that was approved by the probate court, right?
It was approved by the probate court, Judge Johnson. And at the time, he was not told that there was a special needs trust in the offing. He was simply asked to approve a use of some of the proceeds of the malpractice settlement to buy a house for the couple.
Why? Had the special needs trust even been created yet at the time Judge Johnson approved the sale?
No. The sale was approved in December. The special needs trust was created a month later by a different judge, Judge Heather Sweetland.
So even if, let's pause it for a moment that there was never a special needs trust established.
All right.
But nevertheless, the use of the proceeds from the settlement was approved to buy the house in joint tenancy. I mean, I'm just wondering, the harm results from the purchase and joint tenancy.
That's part of the harm. The way it should...
How does a special needs trust affect one way or the other, whether that harm...
The law of the special needs trust obligated the parties to use the special... The parties used the money that should have gone into the special needs trust to purchase the house. Had the money been put into the special needs trust, then the special needs trust would have owned the house.
Right.
And then at the... Had they never done a special needs trust, there'd be no harm. We would not be here today.
Even though the house was purchased in joint tenancy?
Yeah, I think defendant has made the point that there's no law against a married couple owning a house in joint tenancy, and certainly that's the case. But the fact of the matter is that a special needs trust was needed for Mr. Beeman. It was employed, and had the parties behaved in a manner consonant with the requirements, then the proceeds that should have gone into the special needs trust still could have been used to buy the house. Had that been done, the title to the house would be in the special needs trust. Mrs. Beeman would not have been allowed to receive some of the money that ought to have remained in the special needs trust.
Isn't this a collateral attack on what the probate court approved already?
No, it is not. It's a malpractice action. Well, at the time, there are several reasons. One is the district court found it to be a collateral attack when Judge Hilden had earlier held that there was evidence that the courts were misled, perhaps deliberately, perhaps otherwise. But the judges involved in approving all these transactions were unaware of the full nature of the transactions. Now, I want to pause for a moment and make a point. We're here today in an adversary proceeding. If I say something that Mr. Davidson believes is not the law, he can call that to your attention. He will help educate the court on the issues in this case to the extent he believes I have not done an adequate job, and I'm sure he will do that. But all these proceedings that preceded the institution of this malpractice case, there was no adversary. There was only one party. And the party was Mrs. Beeman, represented by the defendant. So to the extent that there was something missing in educating or informing the court, that was not going to be supplied by anybody, because only Mrs. Beeman and Mr. Bojo, the defendant, were present. So nobody told Judge Sweetland that some of the money had been diverted out of the trust to be used to purchase the house. And nobody told Judge... That's part of it. There's more.
What other damages? So let's deal with those. So the damages that relate to the sale of the house.
The house, the $310,000 of Mark Beeman's money were used to purchase the house for both of them. That was money that, by the terms of the special needs trust approved by Judge Sweetland, should not have been used to purchase the house. That's correct.
Okay. So at the time of the purchase of the house, it was authorized to spend that money. The court authorized the spending of the money to buy joint tenancy.
Yes. So then additional monies, I think $250,000 or more, were used to remodel the house.
And are you seeking damages, malpractice damages for that?
Yes.
For the remodeling of the house?
Well, for the cost, the money should not have been used for that. Now you'll say, well, did the judge approve it? Yes. Well, then what is the problem? None of this was proper under the law governing the use of special needs trusts. The money should not have been used to purchase the house in the first place, because the law requires the special needs trust, in order to be valid and enforceable, contain all of the money due to Mark Beeman, and it did not. And nobody told Judge Sweetland that.
I want to go back to the collateral attack issue.
Yes.
Because,
yes.
I mean, are you raising a collateral attack issue, a collateral estoppel issue, or both?
Well, in the context of this case, the two are indistinguishable.
I beg to differ on that. Those are two very distinct issues of law. A collateral attack is when you're going after a previous judgment, whereas collateral estoppel is you're looking at whether or not a decision has already been made.
In the abstract, I agree. But in the context of the facts of this case, I respectfully disagree.
So you're disagreeing on the law between the two. You're saying that two different types, theories of law are indistinguishable here.
I'm saying that in the context of a legal malpractice case, they are. And I think that's what Justice Simonette said.
That was going to be my next question. What authority are you relying on that the two are indistinguishable?
Cook versus Conley, I've cited it in my materials. It was a legal malpractice case in which a minor chose to sue her lawyer for legal malpractice for how he created a settlement of a product liability claim that was approved by a court at the time. Now, the malpractice case did not attack the court's order approving the settlement because the approval of the settlement involved different issues than the legal malpractice case. So is also the case here. I'm not disagreeing that Judge Munger was wrong when he approved various orders involving the administering of this trust. Judge Munger was given the facts, he approved them. I don't think Judge Johnson made a mistake in approving the purchase of the house. I don't think Judge Sweetland can be faulted for approving the creation of the Special Needs Trust. But the manner in which Mr. Bojo secured all these orders was malpractice. And that's what the lawsuit's all about. I'm not questioning the orders of the court.
Is this lawsuit really about malpractice, or is it almost feels like it's trying to do an end around with respect to the settlement agreement that explicitly does not allow Mrs. Beeman to be sued at all?
Well, I can tell you this. At the time that my client decided to bring this lawsuit, that release was not in his mind. It certainly wasn't in mine. We felt that because Mrs. Beeman had relied on Mr. Bojo's advice throughout this entire process, October of 2010 to the end of the dissolution, that he was the real party that was negligent. And Mrs. Beeman testified that everything she did was based on legal advice Mr. Bojo gave her.
I want to go back to a question that my colleague Judge Smith asked with respect to the first part of what the harm that occurred here.
Yes.
And it seems like it really started with the purchase of the house.
Yes.
So that's the first illegal transaction that occurred?
Yes. Well, I believe it was. It wasn't at the time, but when the trust was created, it became illegal. Had the trust never been created, as I conceded to Judge Smith, there would be no malpractice, there would be no negligence.
Okay. So, and when did the purchase of the house begin?
Well, the purchase agreement was signed, I think, in late October of 2010. Yes. Late October of 2010, and the closing was mid-December. And the trust was created in January of 2011.
Okay, so mid-December of 2010 is when the signing was October 2010, and mid-December is when what happened again?
The mid-December, the closing of the house occurred.
The closing, okay, thank you. Well, if that's the case, then why doesn't the statute of limitations apply?
Two reasons. First, the summons and complaint were given to the sheriff on December 6th of 2016, 10 days before the closing on the house occurred. And second reason, the malpractice didn't occur until the special needs trust was created. Had no special needs trust been created, we would not be standing here.
Right, but don't we look at the point of accrual as to when the first illegal transaction took place? Isn't that when the clock starts ticking?
It's when malpractice would have been actionable. And at the time the purchase agreement to buy the house was signed, nobody had been negligent.
Okay. So when I'm looking at your complaint, it asks for $60,000, which represent the proceeds of the homestead that went to Ms. Beeman, and it asks for $27,500.
Those numbers all changed.
I see. Okay. So when you just said a moment ago, had there been no Special Needs Trust created, we wouldn't be here today?
Yeah. I mean, nobody had done anything wrong until the Special Needs Trust was created.
So and if that's the case, then wouldn't Ms. Beeman have her $60,000 without complaint then by Mr. Beeman? Wouldn't she have the $27,500 or whatever other damages that you're alleging?
I suppose that's true. So then you'd say, so then why are we here now? Because, may I answer the question?
Yes, sir.
Because he needed a special needs trust. That was the judgment. They created one, and the proceeds of the settlement that he needed in order to survive were then given to his wife, notwithstanding the advice Mr. Bojo had that a special needs trust was appropriate.
Thank you, Council. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Council for responding. We have 15 minutes.
Morning, mate. Please, the court. My name is William Davidson. I represent the respondent, Randy Bojo. We believe that Judge Hilden's summary judgment order and the summary judgment on appeal here should be affirmed for a couple of reasons. One, the judge's order was not erroneous as it relates to the collateral attack conclusion he reached. It was also not erroneous, more importantly, on the lack of duty and the no intended third-party beneficiary argument that we raised. And then alternatively, as the court's aware, we've raised a related appeal as to the statute of limitations. We believe that Judge Hilden, with all respect, erred in applying the law to that case. When you look at what the plaintiff's theory is, what they've alleged in the complaint, particularly paragraphs 4, 5, and 6, that before the October 19, 2010 purchase agreement, that Mark and Cheryl Beeman signed, committing themselves to earnest money, committing themselves to a potential specific performance lawsuit, their rights became fixed, as it would be under Antone versus Mervis and the like. And that
supports. And I hate to interrupt you, but I want to get right to one.
Yes, Your Honor.
About, it seems appellant's argument here is that, and they've said it a number of times during their oral argument, no malpractice occurred until the special trust, special needs trust was created, and I didn't get a chance to ask Mr. Ballmer this, but it seems to me that argument is then based on the fact that the $300,000 for the house wasn't disclosed to Judge and included in, wasn't disclosed to Judge Sweetland and wasn't included in the special needs trust, and somehow a fraud was committed on the court by that. It seems to me that seems to be the basis for the claim of malpractice here, and so I'd ask that you squarely address that issue.
Sure, Your Honor. That seems to be the argument, and I'm hearing for the first time today this apparent theory that there was no malpractice until the special needs trust, which runs counter to the complaint, which alleges Randy Bojo gave bad advice before they bought the home. And part of that may have been when they drafted the complaint, they didn't know when the purchase agreement was signed, and in fact, that's part of what led to the second summary judgment motion. As to the question specifically, Your Honor, this theory that there was a fraud upon the court, whether it's Judge Johnson or Judge Sweetland, that was raised below, that was presented to Judge Hilden on our first motion, essentially a judgment on the pleadings motion, but converted to and treated as a summary judgment motion, and we may have even characterized it as such. He denied it basically because of the potential for fact issues, and he wanted to allow discovery, and he was concerned about the potential for this theory of fraud on the court. Discovery proceeded. No evidence presented of fraud in the court. There's lots of accusations that it was structured a certain way, that it was hidden. I think if the court were to look closely at the December 2010 order approving the malpractice, the medical malpractice settlement, and when you read the order, the court knew out of the, and I'm not going to disclose the total amount of the medical malpractice settlement because it's confidential, when you look at that amount, less the attorney's fees, less the medical liens that were owed, there was $1.2 million, this is not confidential, left ballpark. Out of that, some $300,000 went to Cheryl Beeman for her loss of consortium claim. Out of that, the court approved some $310,000 to buy a house in joint tenancy.
Net out of the consortium.
Out of the net, the remainder, excuse me, Your Honor. And she specifically said, I think, Judge Johnson specifically said, the net proceeds, whatever's left, shall be held in Paul Schweiger's trust account either for the conservatorship estate, the conservator that already existed, or for a special needs trust to be created. They knew, Judge Johnson knew, certainly the evidence is clear, he knew, there was going to be likely a special needs trust. So this argument or notion that the court was defrauded was, you know, there's a shell game going on here, is belied by the record. Certainly there's no evidence to support a fraud claim. And the notion that a month or so later when Judge Sweetland approves the formation of the trust and then in March, because of a clerical error, actually appoints Ms. Beeman as the trustee, that she was, you know, left in the dark, I think is belied by the record. More importantly, there's no affirmative evidence establishing a fraud on the court. And that would be a way to get around the duty argument. You know, lawyers owe duties to their clients. And in this case, Randy Boggio's client, undisputed evidence, was only Cheryl Beeman, the trust who ultimately became the trustee. To get around that duty argument, one way to get around that would be if the lawyer committed fraud. All lawyers owe duties to their clients. The general rule, no duty owed to a third party, whether it's an opponent or whether it's anyone out there. Now, we're constrained by the rules of professional responsibility. I can't abuse an independent third party witness. I might be subject to some discipline. But I don't owe a duty of care to a non-client. That is clear. Marker versus Greenberg, McIntosh versus Dorsey and Whitney. That is crystal clear. And one way around that would be to come forward with a fraud claim. I, as a lawyer, in representing my client, am not allowed to defraud a third party. I'm not allowed to defraud my opponent. But there's no evidence here of fraud. And recognizing, even though, and fraud was never pled, by the way, and if it had, we would be up here on appeal arguing a Rule 9 argument that there's no fraud alleged with particularity, and certainly no evidence of fraud. So I hope I've addressed your question, Your Honor. I think when you look at the order in December approving the medical malpractice settlement, and when you look at the next order or the next two orders approving the trust and then approving the actual appointment of Cheryl Beeman, there's no fraud here. Would I have liked it to have been better or clearer? Of course. But I think when you look at it, there's no fraud, and there's certainly no evidence of fraud. There's an argument there. True.
It's a malpractice claim against an attorney, which looks like could be common. Why would this be a collateral attack? It doesn't look like you're doing anything.
Of course, Your Honor. First, Judge Hilden's ruling was not collateral estoppel, and that's what Cook versus Connolly is. And yes, I recognize the district court and the Court of Appeals in an en banc, one of the first en banc decisions this court had in Cook versus Connolly, mentions collateral attack. And they are distinct. There are some similarities there. Conceptually, they're somewhat similar. It sounds like it. But I think what Judge Hilden ultimately decided is first he denied our collateral attack motion the first time, granted it the second time. When you look ultimately at what the allegations are and what specifically they wanted to undo, they specifically were attacking the approved judgment of the probate court to allow the purchase of the home in joint tenancy, ultimately what led to the $60,000 of the proceeds of that home. That was a specific a dollar amount account stated, in effect, in the complaint. And unlike... Correct. Where I think this differs from Cook versus Connolly, and I'll admit and concede, I think our strongest argument is the duty argument, and then our next strongest is the collateral attack argument. Where it differs from Cook versus Connolly, I think if the court looks closely at Justice Simonette's majority opinion, I think it was a unanimous decision, may not have been, I apologize, he found, and they discussed very clearly, that John Connolly, the lawyer there, was the lawyer for the minor, now adult plaintiff, even though represented the parent as the guardian for that minor. Here, different situation. Randy Boggio was never the lawyer for Mark Beeman. There's no evidence of that. He was the lawyer for Cheryl Beeman as the trustee for Mark Beeman. And I think that's an important distinction. This is more like the Marker case. Lawyer represented the father, not the son, who was then later disappointed as to how the deed was structured. This is more like the Dorsey and Whitney McIntosh case. Lawyer represented M&S, the folks that put together the participation loan, not the plaintiff banks. This is different than that, but it certainly is, I think, probably one of their better arguments. Perhaps it would have been better if it had been raised below. Notably, I don't think Judge Hilden was faced with or presented with the Cook versus Connolly, and so there may be even a potential waiver argument or Theo versus Stitch argument.
And that statement is based on the fact that collateral estoppel is different than collateral.
It is. They are distinct doctrines.
One doctrine was raised below, the other one is being raised for the first time.
Correct.
But it's not, okay.
I mean, appellant's brief says collateral estoppel, collateral estoppel. That was not the basis for the decision below.
And you're the one who obviously raised that.
We did raise collateral attack below. And I think that when you look at the Greer case, and then if you look at the Stumer case that we cited below, and Judge Hilden in particular looked upon, when you strip everything away, with respect, what they are doing is trying to undo the approved probate court orders. And the law has seemed to have been clear that in probate, you either have to directly appeal that or bring an attack on that jurisdiction. You're not allowed to collaterally attack it indirectly through a malpractice action. Recognizing that Cook versus Connolly comes very close to that line of making that more troubling, which is perhaps why that's not our strongest argument. Ultimately, when you look at Cook versus Connolly, where there was an attorney-client relationship, and you look at Goldberger versus Kaplan, Strangis, and Kaplan, the Goldberger sisters were suing the attorney for the personal representative and also suing the personal representative. There's an important need there to recognize that an attorney, we are unique. We owe duties to our clients and only to our clients. We separately have an obligation to the court, and that is certainly appropriate. We're subject to disciplinary rules. But in terms of a malpractice cause of action, an essential element of an attorney malpractice case, element number one is that there is an attorney-client relationship. And I will stick my head into the buzzsaw here, perhaps. Part of the argument that was raised in a reply was that, and below, under Sinoglaze and Montemayor, and now Warren versus Dinter, and under the Fenwick versus Blake Law School case, and Your Honor, I certainly know you're familiar with Warren versus Dinter, as am I. I will point out a distinction. When Justice Lillehog and the majority in Warren versus Dinter talked about foreseeability and duty, they concluded that Minnesota has never required an attorney or a professional relationship, a doctor-patient relationship, as an element of a Med-Mal claim. Setting that aside, I won't argue that. I lost that case. Minnesota has clearly, repeatedly said there has to be an attorney-client relationship for there to be a legal malpractice case. And that makes sense. Togstead, when you strip it away, there was a fact dispute and there was there an attorney-client relationship? That was deemed to be a fact dispute, I think. And they ultimately came there. But Minnesota has always said there has to be an attorney-client relationship as an element of the claim. In fact, one of the arguments, cases they cite, the more recent Frederick versus Walrick case, I think, a statute of limitations case that turned in part on when was there an attorney-client relationship. Here, undisputed facts, undisputed allegations, the attorney-client relationship was Randy Boggio and Cheryl Beeman, not Randy and Mark Beeman. And to one of the earlier questions from the court, you know, what evidence is there that they retained Randy? There is no evidence. The record is bare of any retainer agreement where Mark retained Randy. The purpose was for the trustee. And when you look at Kaplan versus Strangis, Kaplan Strangis and the Goldberger case and other cases, that makes sense. And this all flows into the intended third party beneficiary issue. Was Randy Boggio's sole job to benefit directly Mark Beeman? And Judge Hilden concluded no, and I think he was right. There certainly may be some overlap there, but his primary job, or part of his job, and that's the distinction, it has to be sole benefit for the intended direct third-party beneficiary.
And why is it not if he was hired to set up a special needs trust?
He was set up to, in part, to set up the special needs trust, and in part to advise the trustee as she performed her duties. And while I concede that in most cases those interests seem aligned and they seem intuitively, it seems like they're kind of doing the same thing, we all know that sometimes beneficiaries and trustees, that's why the property is split amongst the different obligations, may differ. And there may be a short-term need that the trustee or that the beneficiary wants that differs from the trustee's obligation. And so when the professional is advising the trustee, that professional owes only one duty. You can't have two masters. You can't force the professional, the attorney in this case, to have to second guess his or her decisions because they're worried that the beneficiary might not like that result and bring a claim against them. That's correct.
To be able to get and that, but he wasn't hired to represent her personally, apart from being a trustee. I mean, it seems kind of complicated to me as to whether Mr. Dean is not the intended beneficiary, but the representation of the trustee and the, well, of the trustee.
Sure. If I may,
yes, you may.
A couple quick points as to that, Your Honor. Certainly the facts are a little bit complicated here and the like. One, I'll recognize or reiterate, if we're going back that far, statute of limitations would apply if we pursue that path or theory. But why he's not representing both is it was a reasonable decision. And much like Marker versus Greenberg, where although the court said there was no duty, but they later clarified in a footnote in the McIntosh case, actually our holding should have been there was no breach of the duty. That's the situation here. The husband and wife made the decision to buy the house in joint tenancy. And that's a reasonable decision because if they had bought it and it was held by the special needs trust, and if Mr. Beeman were to predecease his then wife, under the existing law then, she'd be homeless and any funds remaining there would be subject to recovery by the state and medical liens. So it's reasonable to structure it that way because of his health concerns and because they're a husband and wife. What we're doing now is Monday morning quarterbacking, with all respect. Nobody foresaw, or it wasn't reasonable, and there was no evidence to foresee that 3-4 years down the road, Mark and Cheryl Beeman's marriage might dissolve. Thank you. We would ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to start where Mr. Davidson ended. The thing that he pointed out here is correct. The purpose of a special needs trust is to enable the beneficiary to continue to be eligible for government benefits. Then when he dies, the proceeds or the race of the trust goes back to the state or the United States government, one of them. And what the purpose of Mr. Bojo's advice to Cheryl Beeman was all throughout this thing was to get as much property out of the trust as possible. And all of his efforts were bent in that direction.
If that's the case, Mr. Ballmer, then do you agree that in order for your malpractice claim to survive, that in light of these various court orders, there had to be some sort of fraud on the court in getting those orders signed or not representing things to the court as they should have been represented?
I prefer misrepresentation, Judge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Setting up the special needs trust, all those orders were available to all those judges as they did their duty. So where was the misrepresentation? What evidence is there that there was a misrepresentation made to any of those judges who approved those orders?
Judge Sweetland signed an order that said that all of the proceeds given to Mark Beeman in the malpractice case went into the special needs trust. That obviously was
available proceeds because didn't, obviously Judge Johnson had depleted part of that settlement through his orders already.
That's correct, Judge Johnson had, but Judge Sweetland was not told that. She was told
I mean it was all right there. I mean she had his orders. course. I mean,
Had she looked, I suppose she would have found it. But there's two problems with that. One is she was not under any notice. There was no reason for her to look. It was a routine establishing of a trust. Nobody told her what the rules surrounding special needs trusts were. I don't know if she knew what they were or not, but I'd be surprised. I mean, she thought she was being asked to approve the formation of a trust for a disabled individual, so she did. But nobody objected.
You're making assumptions of what she did or did not know.
Well, I'm drawing inferences, Your Honor, and at the summary judgment stage, that's permitted. And those inferences are favorable to my client.
I understand those inferences, but usually those are inferences based on the evidence and the record. What you're talking about is inferences in terms of what the court knew about what the record was before the court.
What is clear is that Judge Sweetland was told that all of the money that came to Mark Beeman as a result of the medical malpractice settlement was going into the special needs trust, and that was not true. That was simply not true.
What's the difference between a misrepresentation in what you're trying to argue and a fraud? Because this sounds much, let's start there. What's the difference between misrepresenting information to the court and committing a fraud?
I hesitate to accuse somebody of a deliberate attempt to mislead the judge without more evidence of it. However, there is circumstantial evidence to show that the defendant understood that if he approached this the way he did, that he could probably get the special needs trust approved and get the house in joint tenancy with Mrs. Beeman.
I want to go back to a statement that you made at the very beginning of your rebuttal arguments. You said that you talked about Mr. Boggio providing advice to Mrs. Beeman.
Yes.
If that's the case, isn't that really what he was supposed to do? She's the trustee. He's providing advice to her about how to best set up the special needs trust, and that was one of his areas of expertise, right?
Yes.
So that's why he was brought on, was to advise the trustee. And if that is at least part of the reason, if not the main reason that he was brought on, how can there be any allegation whatsoever that he's also representing Mr. Beeman? Understanding that Mr. Beeman is going to be an indirect beneficiary, but Mr. Beeman is not going to be the direct beneficiary. The direct beneficiary of Mr. Boggio's legal advice and representation is going directly to the trustee, who is Mrs. Beeman.
In the first place, at the time they first met Mr. Boggio, there was no description given to them that if he was retained, he would represent only her. He, Mark Beeman, was never told that ever, ever, ever.
Well, is there any evidence of the contrary, though?
Evidence of that
he was representing Mr. Boggio as well.
Oh, that he was representing Mr. Beeman as well? There are emails that he sent to Katie Erickson and to Mrs. Beeman suggesting that he was giving advice to both of them. They were given to the trial court. I didn't make them part of the addendum.
Are they part of the record?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they are.
Can you emails from Mr. Boggio to
Mr. Boggio and his law firm to Mrs. Beeman and to Katie Erickson? And Katie Erickson was present at these meetings and described both in affidavit and deposition what the conversations were, and you have that evidence.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. There's only one other thing. I know I'm out of time, but foreseeability is a new thing since the Admiral Merchant's decision, which is cited in the materials by respondent, that enshrined Marker versus Greenberg. Foreseeability is an element of whether a third-party beneficiary has a right of action against the lawyer, regardless of whether there's an attorney-client relationship. That's all I got. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you both, counsel. It's very well argued. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time.